This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. This hour, we're going to turn our attention to one of the Democratic contenders in this year's presidential race, Barack Obama. This year, he could become the country's first African-American president. A few days after the South Carolina primary, Obama picked up a key endorsement from the nation's iconic Democratic first family, the Kennedys. Here's Senator Edward Kennedy speaking at American University in Washington in late January.
There is one candidate who has extraordinary gifts of leadership and character matched to the extraordinary demands of this moment in history. He understands what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called the fierce urgency of now. He will be a president who refuses to be trapped in the patterns of the past. He is a leader who sees the world clearly without being cynical. He is a fighter who cares passionately about the causes he believes in without demonizing those who hold a different view. He is tough-minded, but he also has an uncommon capacity to appeal to the better angels of our nature. I'm proud to stand with him here today and offer my help, offer my voice, offer my energy, my commitment to make Barack Obama the next president of the United States.
Senator Edward Kennedy from Massachusetts, whose brother John became the first Catholic president almost half a century ago. JFK's daughter Caroline also endorsed Barack Obama before the Super Tuesday primaries. It is the voters who will decide, of course, and conservative writer Shelby Steele says he thinks the voters won't send Obama to the White House. Shelby Steele puts it even more bluntly in the title of his new book, A Bound Man, Why We Are Excited About Barack Obama and Why He Can't Win. Steele laid out his case in a recent speech at the Commonwealth Club of California, and it's that speech we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. Shelby Steele has studied and written about race in America for decades. In 1990, he received the National Book Critics Circle Award for his book, The Content of Our Character, A New Vision of Race in America. Steele is a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, where he specializes in the study of race relations, multiculturalism, and affirmative action. Like Barack Obama, Shelby Steele also is the son of a white mother and a black father, which he mentions in the speech we are about to hear. Steele's speech, by the way, was made 3 days before the South Carolina primary, which Barack Obama won. Here, then, Shelby Steele at the Commonwealth Club of California on January 23rd, talking about his book, A Bound Man, Why We Are Excited About Barack Obama and Why He Can't Win.
One of the main ideas in this book, and one of the, I think, some important features of black American life from the very, very beginning, is masking, what they call masking. And masking is, I think, plays a very important role in Barack Obama's campaign. And so what I would like to do is read to you a little bit from the chapter on masking, just to give you an idea of what I mean by that term and how it works. I possess a photographic portrait of Louis Armstrong that I treasure greatly. It must have been taken on a hot summer evening fairly late in his life. In it, he is wearing a short-sleeved shirt completely unbuttoned in front. Interestingly, a Star of David hangs from his neck on a thin chain that glints in the sunlight. His right arm rests on its elbow, so that his powerful right hand is conspicuously next to his face, almost like a second face. Pinched between thumb and forefinger of this hand in the characteristic dope smoker's grip, is a half-smoked joint that sends a faint trellis of smoke up into the summer air. I was stunned the first instant I laid eyes on this photograph, but not for its novelty of capturing a celebrity in the act of smoking a joint. It was the look on Armstrong's face that grabbed me. It is perfectly frank and guileless. The eyes are sad, willful, and faintly angry all at the same time. Most of all, they seem tired and quite beyond amusement, as if they have seen absolutely everything there is to see. I love the photograph because its image is a million miles away from the iconic image of Louis Armstrong, the tritely happy figure on the bandstand with the trademark white handkerchief, the broken lip, and the self-effacing grin. This is the real man behind the mask in his full depth and complexity, looking exactly like who he really was, one of the 20th century's greatest artists. So nice, even soothing, to see Armstrong as he really was. I also cherish this photograph as a kind of cultural artifact because its sharp contrast with the familiar image of Armstrong, it symbolizes masking, one of the most interesting and troublesome cultural characteristics of Black American life. Masking is as simple as the fashioning of a face for the world, a face to meet the faces that we meet, as T.S. Eliot once put it. As the word itself makes clear, the mask is not an authentic representation of one's true self. Rather, it is a presentation of oneself that angles for advantage. Imagine Louis Armstrong, born poor, black, and fatherless, growing up in New Orleans at the beginning of the 20th century, in the era in which Jim Crow was entrenching itself across the South. White supremacy was being openly written into the law. A system of racial apartheid was being erected and then enforced by terrorism, the terrorism of lynching, house burnings, and beatings. This was the world in which Louis Armstrong discovered his musical genius. And conversely, it was his genius that propelled him into the larger world and forced him to negotiate it. He was too good to linger his life away on the black side of apartheid. Talent gave him a life on the white side, too. How to handle it? Armstrong adapted a mask that came out of the black minstrel tradition. It was certainly not as sycophantic and self-demeaning as the blackface caricatures of the actual minstrel shows. Still, it did the one thing it had to do. It communicated to white audiences that Armstrong would entertain them, but not presume to be their equal. The relentlessly beaming smile, the handkerchief dabbing away the sweat, the reflexive bowing, the exaggerated humility and graciousness, all this signaled that he would not breach the manners of segregation, the propriety that required him to be both cheerful and less than fully human. In other words, Armstrong's mask was a small offering of black inferiority. It was something he had to give to whites, at least a slight concurrence with their mythology of white supremacy and black inferiority. This also amounted to a gift of innocence to whites, because it said that their racism was not prejudice, but truth. A truth that he himself would observe. And this little gift of innocence, this slight homage to whiteness, was a part of the show. It helped white people in a segregated society enjoy themselves without guilt. And it enabled them to cherish Louis Armstrong. For the oppressed, and even for those who simply belong to minority groups, Masking is always an attempt to offset the power differential that so favors those born to the mainstream. Armstrong's mask allowed him to exercise power in a society bent on keeping power away from his kind. It helped him offset the power differential with whites by giving him a livelihood in the broad American mainstream that he was not meant to have. Bing Crosby, to the mainstream born, did not have to wear a mask of racial self-effacement in order to win an audience. The masks that blacks wear in American society are always strategic, always based on a reading of what is possible in white America. And so we blacks are never quite what whites think we are. Our entire history in America is a history of, among other things, masking. Today's ferocious black obsession with unity, particularly among the black leadership, is simply an obsession with giving the group mask the uniformity it needs to be powerful. Our manipulation of whites requires that we all be on the same page, behind the same mask. Whites have trouble reading blacks because we are always showing them only what we want them to see, always pushing them this way and that. We always have two narratives, what we tell each other and what we tell whites.
We're listening to a recent speech by Shelby Steele, author of A Bound Man, Why We Are Excited About Barack Obama and Why He Can't Win. Steele spoke at the Commonwealth Club of California on January 23rd. This is word for word from American Public Media.
Next section I go on to talk about Miles Davis, who also wore a mask, very different than the mask that Armstrong wore. But when you are a minority and you live in a society where people have enormous power and over you, then masking is a survival mechanism, and so it is built into the culture. My point ultimately will be that it has now become a problem for us, and that I think we now have an opportunity to move beyond it. Nevertheless, old habits die hard. Let me now just talk a little bit about the kinds of masks that we wear in American life when we enter the American mainstream and we want to do business there. There are really two kinds, bargaining and challenging is what I call them. Bargainers are blacks who come to white America and essentially say, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to presume that you are not a racist. I'm going to just presume that. I'm going to bet on your better self if you will not hold my race against me. This is a very flattering bargain for whites. It's interesting because the bargainer is basically saying, you're better than whites were in the past when this was a racist society. You're a better human being than that, and I'm going to bet on that, and I'm going to take a risk with you. And so inevitably, whites in that circumstance often are more vigilant against racism than blacks are because their self-esteem is tied to it, their sense of themselves as being beyond this shame that happened in the past. So whites respond to this bargain with gratitude, call this the gratitude factor, and with affection, and often with warmth. The great bargainer of our time is Oprah Winfrey. You can tell a bargainer because there is this sort of almost special aura. They have something, they may be very often very talented people, but they have something even more than that. Oprah's a good example of that. Bill Cosby was a great bargainer back in the 80s. Sidney Poitier before him. But Cosby basically said to America, If you watch my television show every week, I will never shame you. I will never rub racism, America's racist past in your face. You can watch my show comfortably because I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt. And his show became, obviously, extremely successful. Challengers, on the other hand, are the opposite. Challengers say, I will never give you the benefit of the doubt. Our power, our black power, is based on keeping whites on the hook, keeping them feeling obligated to us. And so we presume that they are racist until they prove to us otherwise by giving us some form of racial preference or other. Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson are the great challengers of the moment. And the problem that both of these gentlemen had in running for the presidency is that it's very difficult to do that as a challenger because you're constantly, in a sense, manipulating and shaming the people you're asking to support you. So neither of their candidacies ever had much of a chance. Barack Obama is interesting because he is the first one to bring bargaining into politics, to try to make it a source of actual political capital, political power. And he's done a very good job of doing that. I think that in the subtitle, Why Are We Excited About Obama? Well, Obama's, and for one thing, he is an extremely talented politician. He's probably more gifted on that level than anybody else in the race on either side of the aisle. He can seize an issue and frame it and articulate it in an amazing way with great clarity. He obviously speaks well. He is obviously good strategically and has responded to his opponents very well all along. It's not perfect, but boy, coming from the Illinois State Legislature only 2 years ago, that takes considerable talent. But beyond this talent comes this warm glow that bargainers always attract to themselves because he's on a higher level, on an allegorical level. He is making a bargain with white America. He's saying, I'm like Cosby. I'm like Oprah. You can vote for me, and I will never shame you. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to bet on your better selves. Well, it is, again, such a flattering mask that white Americans, ironically, have become Barack Obama's political base. Not black Americans, but white Americans. It was white Americans who sort of launched him in Iowa. Well, again, I think that has a lot to do with this mass, this bargaining that he does. And so, again, he gives white Americans this opportunity, in a sense, to act out their better halves. There is a problem with bargainers. Bargainers always have one profound problem. I mean, it's not much of a problem if you are in entertainment, as let's say Oprah is. But if you are in politics, I think it becomes a problem. I think it becomes an Achilles heel. The golden rule that bargainers can never break, they can never tell you what they really, truly think. They can never tell you what their deepest convictions are. They can never tell you what their ideological orientation is. They have to keep it, they have to, in a sense, nurture a degree of invisibility. Because, in a sense, they're offering themselves to the American public as a projection screen. Americans, white Americans, are seeing in this candidate their better selves. And that's the warmth, the affection. If bargainers start to tell you what they really and truly think, many of the people who support them will say, I didn't know you thought that. I didn't know you I didn't know you were for preemption here. I didn't know you supported racial preferences. I didn't know you were this way. And so in order to keep the aura going, keep the excitement, keep the charisma, invisibility is nurtured. A good example of this, Bill Cosby, again, who was one of the great bargainers of all time in the 1980s with his television show. He was America's father. All of a sudden, in the last few years, Bill Cosby's begun to tell us what he really thinks. He said, I don't care what white people or black people think. This is what I really think. Boom. No longer is he the iconic figure that he once was, when he was invisible, when his feeling, his true feelings were invisible. One of the ways you can always tell bargainers is that they're always used to sell things. Tiger Woods sells, God knows, everything in the world. Cosby did in the 80s, Jell-O being just one. Oprah can put her sticker on a book and it immediately there's a million copies sold. The reason that this is the case is that bargainers have established, in making this bargain with white America, they've established a reciprocity with white Americans, a kind of mutual identification with white Americans. And so what many corporations have realized, though probably not consciously, is that this can easily be commercially exploited. People love Oprah in a special way. And so she can sell a lot of books. Cosby could sell a lot of Jell-O back in the 80s. The problem is that, again, if they become visible, here's what Bill Cosby said. I think blacks should be a lot more responsible for advancing themselves. No matter what else, I think they should be. Woo. Now, how many people are going to stand beside Bill Cosby? If whites stand beside Bill Cosby, they're going to be seen as a racist. They may privately admire him, but if they stand beside him, they're going to be seen as a racist. If blacks stand beside him, a man saying that blacks need to be more responsible, then they're going to be seen as Uncle Toms. So visibility kills off the special glamour that bargainers have, the magic, iconic status that they have in society. This, I think, is the Achilles heel of Barack Obama. If he begins to give us what his real ideological orientation is toward the world, then he's going to lose a lot of that magic and no longer have, and he will have to run as an individual. Now he runs and is supported much more for what he represents to American society than for who he is. He represents something wonderful, something that decent people everywhere would love to support, racial transcendence. And so I'm voting for racial transcendence. I want that too. Everybody wants that. But then there's the other question. If we're going to put the power of the American presidency in your hands, we need to know what you're going to do with it. We need to know when you're going to take the country to war and when you're not going to take the country to war. We need to know specifics. We need to know what principles do your positions come out of. What ideological orientation do you have? He says, well, I'm post-ideology. No. If you're alive and breathing, you've got an ideological orientation. That's an extension of who we are as individuals. If you really don't have one, that's a little scary. So Obama, in that sense, I think he may go all the way. I don't know. But my bet is that at some point this is going to catch up with him. And Americans are going to finally want to know, are you conservative? Are you liberal? Are you, what are you? Who what are you? I know who Hillary is. I know who Edwards is. I can take them or I can leave them. They're very forthright about who they are. Same thing on the Republican side of the aisle. They're very forthright about their point of view and their philosophy, very clear. But who's Barack Obama? I think, finally, that the Barack Obama phenomenon is much, much more about white America than it is about Barack Obama. He's just a guy, just a man, very talented, yes. But the phenomenon that has surrounded him for the last couple of years, no man could win that on his own. There has to be a hunger within the American society itself that is pulling him forward, calling him forward. And he then, of course, as long as he can remain invisible, can ride that wave and amass considerable political capital. But the story is the story of white America. And in many ways, it is a very positive, very good story. Since the 1960s, the civil rights victories and so forth, Civil Rights Bill, Voting Rights Act, my opinion is that white Americans have made one of the greatest moral evolutions in all of human history. I don't know anywhere else in the world where a people have transformed themselves morally that far in that relatively short period of time. I grew up in segregation. I went to segregated schools. I know what segregation is like. I know what it's like to look in the face of somebody who is quite comfortable with their racism, who feels that it's just a part of nature, no offense. And then I saw the society rocked and after the mid-60s set out on a different course. And today, the worst thing that can happen to a white person is to be labeled a racist. They're a pariah. Their career evaporates. And there's no redemption. And when they die on their obituary, the racial mistake they made will be the first lie. With regard to racism, we are puritanical. We've become probably a little more laissez-faire in our sexual mores as a society. But in terms of racism, we are absolutely puritanical, unforgiving, and severe. Whew. That's a big... That is a big change. So white Americans have been struggling with this on some level for 40 years now. And so here comes a black candidate who looks like he may give this society a chance to even go further, to sort of complete something. Because wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if a largely white society put a black man in the presidency? Wouldn't that say that we have transcended racism? We are no longer a racist society. That's an extremely appealing and compelling proposition. Well, Barack Obama embodies it. And so he has this magic that doesn't come from him. Rather, it comes from the hunger in white America to move beyond this racial divide that we have had in the past for so long. My feeling is, therefore, because Obama is a bargainer and has done very well in that regard, that he really represents an old paradigm, not a new one. He's not fresh. He's doing the same thing Louis Armstrong had to do. Sidney Poitier had to do. He's not breaking that mold. He's using that mold to gain power and authority. I wish and hope for him, he's a very young man, that he become an individual. Seems to me the goal in life, when we're talking about race and racial issues, is to become not a black person, but an individual. So that when you see me and you see my race, it doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't point to a politics or an ideology or any of those things. You have to get to know me as an individual. That's what I'd love to see Barack Obama do. He comes from a fascinating and rich background. If he really looked at it and evolved an individuality out of it, he could truly bring something fresh that we've never seen before in American politics. But again, he has not done that. And so I fear that he is a bound man, that he's in a situation that is almost impossible. If he does go all the way, it will not be because of him, not be because he's offering us a new vision. He's offered us absolutely no vision. It will be because the hunger in white America is so profound that they'll put him there anyway. That may happen. If that happens, I'll have to eat my subtitle here. But I don't think it will be because of Obama. I think it will be because of the need, the hunger in the larger society.
Shelby Steele, a conservative scholar and fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, speaking January 23rd at the Commonwealth Club of California. Steele's new book is A Bound Man, Why We Are Excited About Barack Obama and Why He Can't Win. You're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After delivering his speech, Shelby Steele took questions from the audience, read by moderator Lisa Vorderbruggen.
Why is it that we cannot transcend race? Why is it that the promise of Obama that you mentioned in your book, you even posed the question, isn't America's fascination with him precisely his potential for diffusing race as a national obsession? Do you think you're being overly pessimistic?
I hope not. You know, I think that it's dangerous to wade into political waters without a degree of skepticism. You know, a man who can say, I want change and I'm for hope and I'm going to bring people together, and never tell you change from what to what, and you become mesmerized with that, that's close to demagoguery. That's not healthy in a democracy. Who the hell is Barack Obama? He should be evaluated in every conceivable way. He should be put to every test. We should ask a lot of someone who wants to have that kind of power in their hand.
Now, a member of this audience has written here that Barack Obama has told who he is in his books and on his campaign trail. Why can't we believe that that's what he is?
Well, he has a lot of policy statements. His last book, The Audacity of Hope, the first book, Dreams from My Father, is a really fine memoir. It'll be around for a long, long time. He is a beautiful writer in many ways. The second book is more of a politician's book, where he takes on every issue under the sun. But it's a bit like watching a ping pong match. He can beautifully express the conservative position on an issue, then go over and beautifully express the liberal position on an issue. But we never know what his position is. We never finally see. Most importantly, I know that Hillary Clinton, for example, is a post-60s liberal who likes government, who believes that government can be an instrument of virtue, that government can and should be used to improve the lives of people, particularly poor people. I know that when she gets, that's her ideological outlook. I know that when she gets in, that's what she's going to try to do. I can sign on with that, or I can look for another candidate. What is Obama going to do? What's his ideological outlook? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. Sometimes I wonder if he does. I talk about in the first half of the book, he comes from a, he's abandoned by his African father when he was the age of two. And so in one fell swoop, he lost both a father and a racial identity. So here's this sort of, this black kid being raised in a white family in Hawaii. So there's this vacuum, not only of the for the father, but for this racial identity in a time when America's obsessed with identity politics and everybody's running around talking about their identity. Obama became obsessed with it himself. And went to the arc of his life is basically trying to achieve this sense of belonging with blacks, this racial authenticity. I come from the same background Obama does. I'm older. I grew up in segregation. There were not so many options available. And I was lucky enough to have to be raised by an intact family with a wonderful father and so forth. Still, in the 60s, I felt compelled as somebody from an interracial background to make sure that people understood I was authentically black. Went to great ends to do that. Wasn't really conscious of it at the time. But I did do it. Okay, what's the problem with that? The problem with that is, and this is why I finally abandoned those efforts, the problem is that in order to fit yourself in to the going idea of what it means to be black, you have to betray yourself. So you achieve this group identity through 1,000 little self-betrayals. You make self-betrayal a habit, a way of getting on in the world. And the problem with that is that you are not individuating. You are not becoming an individual. You are wearing a mask for this group, mask for that group, and so forth. There may be some of that in Obama. There just may be some. I don't know. There is a lot of accommodation. And again, this, I think, is why he's bound. The black identity is grounded today and challenging. They want to keep whites on the hook. Obama is surviving by letting whites off the hook. So he's always had problems with blacks. Because of that, when he goes over and starts to look like a challenger, and in order to get the black vote, whites say, "We liked you precisely because you weren't that way."
Are you, Dr. Steele, a bargainer or a challenger?
Good question. I've done both. Most blacks do. When I was in college and I was trying to nail down my black authenticity, and I had an afro out to here, and which I can't do anymore, I was a challenger. Led the Black Student Union into the president's office at my college and took it over, and confrontation, and we'll presume you're racist till you prove otherwise. Other times, as my career got started, was bargained. These are, again, here's something that's really interesting. Give you an example. In Barack Obama's book, Dreams for My Father, he says, when I was a teenager, he's about 15, 16 years old, he said, I realized that if if you that whites would like you if you never got mad, if you didn't show anger. He knew what bargaining was even then. You learn these things instinctively. It's almost a Pavlovian conditioning, because you meet whites, and when they see that you are not angry, there's a little happiness. There's a little, I like you. It's perfectly understandable. It goes back to the long history that we've all endured in race in this society. Nothing wrong with that. I remember when they didn't care what you did or what you said. Bargaining is something you're not conscious of it, but you do it. By the time I was well into my career, 70s, 80s, I got really sick of it and just disgusted. And it seemed to me, what was the point of having civil rights legislation if you can't function in this society as an individual? And so that's when I really began to write about race with absolute honesty, the way that just to simply say what I really thought, knowing full well that I was going to alienate almost everybody. But boy, was it the sense of liberation, the sense of freedom that came with that made it all worthwhile. So I loathe those masks. I don't wear them. I don't make a bargain with whites. I don't challenge whites. I deal with them. I tell them what I think. Same thing with blacks. I am proud to be black, but my culture is not my master. I am. And they can't tell me what to do and what to think. And I wish that kind of freedom for other blacks. When we get to that point, boy, we will. That's as good as the promised land.
Shelby Steele, conservative writer and fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, speaking in late January at the Commonwealth Club of California. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Dr. Steele, did you talk to Obama for your book, and what do you suspect is behind his masking, as you describe it?
No, I didn't talk to him about this book. I brushed past him one day in the Capitol, and that's the sum total of my being in any proximity to him. I didn't want to talk to him. When somebody's involved in a presidential campaign, they're not going to sit down and have a heartfelt discussion with you about the intimate details of their life. It's just not going to happen. I fully understand that. But yet, Obama had already done that. His first book is a really brave book. I wish he had followed up on that, where he really does look at himself and really talks about his life very honestly and unsparingly, and which is what makes it such a good book. What was the second question? The second part of that?
What do you suspect is behind Obama's masking, as you describe it?
Again, this is a kid who grew up in American society. As he said, he realized when he was a teenager that if you're not angry, whites will like you. He just from daily experience. So he did not, and I don't mean to imply that Barack Obama said, I think I'm going to become a bargainer. That's how I'm going to get into the American mainstream. I don't think that's the way it happened. I think what Barack Obama realized is that he had a facility, a talent, to get people to like him.
And how is that? And how is that different, Dr. Steele, than any of us who do what works for us in our lives? If we become successful, we model our personalities to do what works for us. How is that different? Because he's black.
It's different because it's a racial mask. And you know that's what's wrong, is that the whole race becomes accountable to that. And as long as we have these two masks, as a group, within a group, we become intolerant of those who want to break out. of those who want not to wear the mask anymore. Again, Bill Cosby is a great example. When you don't wear masks, you enter, in at least in a metaphorical sense, you enter a kind of exile. Because now you're not trading with anybody. Nobody can, you're not going to get anywhere trading with Shelby Steele. I always use the example Don Imus. When Don Imus got in trouble, he didn't run to Colin Powell. He ran to Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton could give him absolution because he's a challenger. And, of course, Al Sharpton rose up and didn't give it to him. But he couldn't go to Condoleezza Rice. She's an individual. She doesn't claim any capacity to absolve another race.
For our next question, Dr. Steele, assuming, as you do, that Barack Obama cannot win the presidency, what will be the impact of his bid for the presidency on blacks in America and America as a whole?
That's a good question. One of the impacts I think that it will have, it already has had, what is just so fantastic about Barack Obama's bid is that he has shown us a different society than we thought we had. When you win a state that's 95% white, that's a different. I went to college in Iowa. That's not the Iowa that was there back in the mid '60s. That's a different society, and so it gives all of Americans something to be proud of. I am proud of Barack Obama. I'm also proud of white America. I'm proud of the people who support him. I don't demean them. I want the same things they want. The same thing. I want that kind of racial transcendence. I just want him to come down to earth a little bit and be a little bit more of a real politician and tell us what he thinks and feels. But this is a proud moment for America. Where else could this happen? I haven't seen it happen in England or France. We should be proud of ourselves.
Dr. Steele, for our next question, our audience member asks, you mentioned bargaining and confrontation as two styles, but is it an either-or situation?
Well, bargaining and challenging, to answer the first part, are not mutually exclusive. Sometimes you bargain, sometimes you challenge. I tend to think that people tend in one direction, but they're masks that are not mutually exclusive. And the same person can use both of them.
Well, that's a segue to the next question. Was Martin Luther King a bargainer or a challenger? I think he was both. Did his leadership ultimately prevail? My premise is that people respond to leadership, especially if the time is right.
Martin Luther King challenged. But, you know, he was also, and more importantly, an individual. He came along at a time when he was trying to eradicate four centuries of racial oppression. Well, that's an authentic thing for him to be doing. There's no, and he wasn't even really, in a sense, just saying, "I'm going to hold you on the hook to sort of get." He wanted this to stop. He wanted it to end. So he was one of the. I would have to count him as an individual more than even though he did challenge.
For our next question, as a teacher, I have met with challengers and bargainers daily. Perhaps she has teenagers in her class. They are a projection of their parents' feelings. Do you have ideas on how to deal with this dilemma and have an honest and open learning experience together?
I would try to encourage their individuality. You know, this gets into my last book, White Guilt. Whites know. They live under a kind of terror. If they slip up, they get, you know, misspeak in some way, that stigma of being seen as a racist just sort of comes down. The problem with that for us as blacks is that whites very, very rarely ever tell us the truth, tell us what they really think. And if they sort of gear their message in a way that is politically correct and won't, rather than say what very often they know to be true. So the problem is we as blacks live in a bubble, in a sense, where we don't get honest communication from our fellow citizens. This hurts us. This cuts us off from a communication that could be very helpful. So in this situation of teaching, I would try to find ways to say what I really think. If somebody's bargaining, if somebody's challenging and not being themselves, say it. That everybody benefits then.
Why Obama and why now?
Because Obama is a natural-born bargainer, and because white America is ready, is hungry, wants to take their moral evolution in a step further. There are many millions of Americans, white, who want a black president, who want to overcome this terrible history that we had. This is Obama, again, is a phenomenon that comes from white America. And I think it says very good things about white America. I would just ask those who support him to ask more of him. Ask him to put his cards on the table and tell us what he really believes and give us a reason to actually vote for him and stop being so invisible.
Thank you so much, Dr. Steele.
Thank you very much.
Shelby Steele, conservative and African-American writer. He is a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. His most recent book is A Bound Man, Why We Are Excited About Barack Obama and Why He Can't Win. Steele made his presentation to the Commonwealth Club of California on January 23rd, 3 days before the presidential contender won the South Carolina primary. If you missed part of this hour's speech by Shelby Steele, or if you would just like to hear it again, our website is the place to go. It's wordforword.org. There, you may hear this week's show and subscribe to our free weekly podcast. You may also hear campaign stump speeches by all of the candidates, Democrat and Republican, who are seeking their party's nominations. And in our archives of previous programs, you'll find speeches by, among others, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, offering advice to the president-elect, Second Lady Liz Cheney, and Harlem Congressman Charles Rangel. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Larissa Anderson and associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. The technical director is Sam Keenan, with help this week from Michael Osborne.
American Public Media.